Politics Uncensored with Ali Milani and Zoe Grunewald on Fubar Radio.
Hello, you're listening to Politics Uncensored with me, Ali Milani.
And me, Zoe Grunewald.
Coming up, the Southport killer, Axel Rudakabana, has in the last hour been sentenced to life in prison with a minimum of a 52-year sentence for the murder of three young girls and the attempted murder of 10 others. We'll ask, what needs to be done to prevent such horrific acts from happening again after the Prime Minister vowed to change the laws around knives, terrorist legislation and announced a public inquiry into how this atrocity was allowed to happen.
We'll also be looking at how Labour wants to deal with Donald Trump as he began his second term in the White House this week after it was revealed that a mini cabinet has been set up by the Prime Minister to try and plan around Trump's notorious unpredictability. But will past comments by members of Keir Starmer's cabinet about the president come back to haunt them?
As always, you can find us at Politics Uncensored UK on social media. All that and more coming up later in the programme.
But first, it's the Week Unwrapped.
I'm now going to sentence Axel Rudakabana, having explained my reasons. On counts 1 to 3 murder, I sentence him to custody for life with a minimum term which he must serve in custody of 52 years, less the time he's served already. He's been in custody for 175 days on remand, which will be credited. Therefore, the minimum term is 51 years and 190 days. On counts 4 to 11, I sentence him concurrently to custody for life with a minimum term of 18 years, less 175 days served, on each count concurrently with each other. Allowing for his time served on remand, the minimum term on those counts is 17 years and 190 days. On counts 12 and 13, I sentence him concurrently to custody for life with a minimum term of 16 years, less his time served on remand, on each count concurrently with each other, leading to a minimum term on those counts of 15 years and 190 days. On counts 14 and 16, I sentence him to 18 months custody concurrently with each other and all other offences. He will pay the appropriate amount under 18 statutory charge, which will be entered on the court record. Accordingly, in total, I sentence Rudakabana to 13 sentences of custody for life and a minimum term to be served in custody of 51 days and 190 days.
Axel Rudakabana, who murdered three young girls and attempted to murder 10 other people, has been sentenced today to life in prison with a minimum of 52 years. Elsie Dot Stanku, 7 years old, BB King, 6 years old, and Alice De Silva Aguirre, 9, died while eight other children and 2 adults, dance class leader Leanne Lucas and businessman Jonathan Hayes, were seriously wounded. The now 18-year-old refused to come into the courtroom as he was sentenced at Liverpool Crown Court, having been removed from the dock earlier due to his disruptive behaviour, which included demands to see a paramedic and shouts of, "I feel ill." Earlier, the court heard harrowing details of the attack, including how Rudakabana arrived in a taxi, booked under a fake name, and how an instructor told the children to run away, and how a local man was injured as he tried to help. Dance instructor Leanne Lucas was stabbed 5 times. In a statement in court, she told the victims, "I'm surviving for you." While in custody after the attacks, Rudakabana said, "I don't care, I'm feeling neutral. Literally, such a good thing those kids are dead." He also admitted producing ricin, possessing terrorist material and possessing a knife. Ali, this is just one of the most horrific stories in recent British history, and we'll be discussing the details around it with an expert and former police officer later in the programme. But let's talk a bit about the sort of charges that Rudakabana has been found guilty on. Terrorism was something that was coming up a lot during the court case and in the months since the Southport riots. But actually, there's been a lot of contention over whether or not this was a terrorist act. What can you tell us about what has been discussed at a political level about the motivations behind Rudakabana's crime?
Yeah, so look, traditionally, when people talk about terrorism, what actually underpins whether something is determined a terrorist attack is whether there's an ideological, political reason behind it. And so terror is being used to advance a political or ideological cause. It's clearly the case, I think, following the trial, that this was not the case. This was a deranged man who was unwell, mentally sort of not there, and who committed a heinous attack on three young innocent girls and attempted to kill many more. And so in the strictest sense, there's no political ideology behind what he did. Now, but that, bear that in mind, there are a lot of critics who also say that terrorism is a term that's usually used for Muslim perpetrators, and he wasn't Muslim, to the best of my knowledge, anyway. And so there is that criticism. But what I think is a conversation worth having now, look, on this case, it is one of the most horrific cases, certainly of our lifetimes, that we have seen. But this is someone who's now been tried, been sent to prison for their crime. The Prime Minister gave a speech that talked about how the new threat of extreme violence is no longer from highly organized groups like Al-Qaeda, and rather it's moving towards extreme violence by what he called loners, misfits, young men in their bedrooms accessing material online. And this is something that I am concerned about, and I think the PM is right on. I think we are heading into an age of extremism and terrorism where the ideology isn't foreign policy that happened somewhere, or even extremist religious positions, whether that be of any religion. But I actually think we're headed towards misogyny being one of the key indicators of extremism, and sort of loneliness, radicalization online of young men. Often we have this image of them being kind of locked away in their bedrooms, and I think that we can expect these young men who are being radicalized in their parents' basements, who often will espouse views that are consistent with hating women, for example, and who are sort of indoctrinated by some pretty far right wing, misogynistic, hateful online commentators. I think we may be headed towards that being a serious threat. I'm curious about your thoughts.
I think it's interesting. I agree with Keir Starmer's analysis, and I think we can talk about, you know, the increasing radicalization of young men, but whether expanding the definition of terrorism to include this kind of indiscriminate level of violence, I don't know whether or whether actually sort of you're right. Terrorism is a kind of defunct phrase to actually deal with the kind of just anger and hate and violence we're seeing from what seems to be particularly groups of young isolated men. I just want to ask you quickly before we move on. So Keir Starmer has ordered a public inquiry into the Southport attack. Why do you think they've done this inquiry? Do you think part of it is political because we know that this led to the Southport riots back in the summer and riots across the rest of the country? What do you think an inquiry is useful in this particular incident?
Not really. Look, I think he's definitely called a national inquiry because of the political pressure. We've seen Nigel Farage, for example, claim to know things about cover-ups and other things in the media. And there's a huge amount of pressure, particularly from the far right, on the Prime Minister apparently knowing things and not releasing them quick enough or not saying things publicly. Again, this is nothing new. I've spoken about how there seems to be nowhere that the far right in this country aren't willing to go for their own political gains. The reality is, I think a lot of the industry experts already know what needs to happen, already know the shifts that are happening. National inquiries tend not to actually lead to action as much as we would like. I think I spoke a couple of weeks ago about how the Grenfell inquiry, the post office inquiry, all these national inquiries that we've done, only one person has been prosecuted as a result. So they don't tend to lead to a whole lot of action. I think I would much rather we do things and move quickly rather than appease the political agenda of the far right. But I think we're going to be talking about this more with a guest later on.
Okay, let's move on. It's been a hectic few days in Washington as Donald Trump begins his second term as president.
Our liberties and our nation's glorious destiny will no longer be denied, and we will immediately restore the integrity, competency, and loyalty of America's government. Over the past 8 years, I have been tested and challenged more than any president in our 250-year history, and I've learned a lot along the way. The journey to reclaim our republic has not been an easy one, that I can tell you. Those who wish to stop our cause have tried to take my freedom and indeed to take my life. Just a few months ago, in a beautiful Pennsylvania field, an assassin's bullet ripped through my ear. But I felt then, and believe even more so now, that my life was saved for a reason. I was saved by God to make America great again.
It's been 4 days since President Donald Trump took office, and he has, of course, come out of the block swinging. On the 2024 campaign trail, Trump promised to bring rapid and sweeping change to American government and society if he were elected. Some of his policies and reforms will take time and congressional legislation to enact, but other moves might be blocked by the courts. In the first days of his presidency, however, Trump has already made waves with dozens of unilateral orders and actions that represent a substantial expansion of White House power, including declaring a national emergency on the US-Mexico border and issuing a broad ban on asylum for migrants, signing an order calling for the elimination of government diversity programs that includes ending of all federal offices and jobs related to diversity, equity and inclusion, ordered federal workers back to the office full time and agencies to take steps to halt remote work, issued a freeze on federal hiring except for military immigration, enforcement, national security and public safety jobs, declared a national energy emergency to expand energy production, scrap regulations and end rules aimed at expediting a transition to electric vehicles, and pardoned about 1,500 of his supporters who attacked the US Capitol 4 years ago. And he ordered the US to withdraw from the Paris Climate Accord and the World Health Organizations. For many of his supporters so far, it looks like he has delivered on his promises. Ali, whether we agree with him or not, is that the right appraisal? Do you think he is delivering for the people who voted for him?
I think he's moving really, really quickly. And it's clear that where a lot of Trump won was tied up in litigation and tied up in these debates surrounding what he can and cannot do and the sort of state kind of tempering what he's able to do this time. He's going to move really, really quickly. The one thing I'd like to point out is he said in his inauguration speech that he is, as president, been tested and challenged more than any president in their 200-plus year history. I'm not sure he was challenged more than Abraham Lincoln during the Civil War that America had, or even George Washington during the War of Independence, although he wasn't president at the time. So it does give you an indication that attempt on his life really did change him, and it seems to have focused him on sort of doing what he believes he needs to do. And his team are laser focused in, I think, delivering in a way that they didn't in term one, and there is nothing off the table for them. This time there will be no rules, no norms that they're not willing to blow through.
Okay, well, we're going to talk a bit more about that later in the programme, but let's come back home for a minute. It's good news for the Yimbys, but bad news for the Nimbys.
We will also reform the planning system to deliver the infrastructure that our country needs. Together, in these early days of this new Labour government, we will ask the Secretary of State for Transport and the Secretary of State for Energy Security and Net Zero to prioritise decisions on infrastructure projects that have been sitting unresolved for far too long.
That was the Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, speaking last year. Now, Sir Keir Starmer has announced plans to block campaigners from making repeated legal challenges to planning decisions for major infrastructure projects in England and Wales as part of their drive for economic growth. Number 10 says the proposals will prevent cynical and hopeless appeals blocking new nuclear power stations, roads, railway lines and wind farms. The PM vowed to end a challenge culture by taking on the NIMBYs, an acronym for Not In My Backyard, who he said stood in the way of growth. Well, the Conservatives welcomed the initiative but said the government must also scrap environmental regulations, which they say increase the cost of major projects. And according to the government, more than half of decisions on nationally significant infrastructure projects are taken to court, causing an average delay of 18 months and adding millions to costs. Ali, this is, you know, the right decision, you could say, for economic growth. But do you think it's fair to say the NIMBYs sometimes have a point?
Look, I'm certainly not in the NIMBY camp, but I just want to clarify what it seems the government is doing. So currently, opponents of major schemes have three real opportunities to get a judicial review, which is to pause a major sort of development and have it looked at through, amongst other things, legal lenses. So they can write to the High Court, then in an oral hearing, and finally by appealing to the Court of Appeals, they can demand a judicial review. The government's proposal is essentially scrapping the written stage of that, which would mean that campaigners would have to persuade a judge in person to order a judicial review. So while I'm not a YIMBY, and I do think that we need to sort of open up the building and infrastructure projects around the country to move the country into the future, we're lagging so far behind other major economies in terms of our infrastructure. This does sort of support the arguments around Starmer being quite authoritarian and heavy-handed by removing these. And organizations like Friends of the Earth have said that there's an attempt to scapegoat people with valid concerns about the different projects' impacts. And let's not forget that Sir Keir Starmer himself was one of the people, as an MP, with a what he would call a valid objection to High Speed Rail 2. Not long ago, he was delivering petitions to Number 10 and to the then Conservative government around the impacts, not least environmental impacts, of HS2 at the time, which has been drastically reduced anyway. So while I am more of a build infrastructure view, I think this is a sort of dangerous road that the government could go down in terms of ordering campaigners to have to, in person, get judges to order a judicial review. But it seems the YIMBYs are seriously losing in Westminster now.
So obviously we know Rachel Reeves is at Davos this week, and she seems to have dropped some major hints that they may reaffirm the backing of the expansion of Heathrow Airport, particularly a third runway. This is likely to go down very, very badly with the Climate Secretary Ed Miliband, who is understood to oppose the expansion, and of course the Mayor of London, Sadiq Khan, who has gone public with concerns about his plan.
And Ali Milani, who used to be councillor for Heathrow.
Because they are worried about the government's push for net zero. And it seems like increasingly the net zero push may be coming into conflict with the growth plan. So in the battle of Rachel Reeves versus Ed Miliband, Sadiq Khan and Ali Milani, who's going to win?
Unfortunately, I think Rachel Reeves might win. But look, the reality is London is, I mean, I don't want to give my spiel on why I'm so anti-third runway at Heathrow, other than to say that if Rachel Reeves moves ahead with a third runway at Heathrow, it would completely set fire to any climate credibility that this government has. It would be the single most damaging infrastructure project in terms of health and climate to London in my lifetime. London is serviced by more airports than any other major city in most of the world. We have London Stansted, London Gatwick, London Luton, London Southend, London Heathrow, London Luton, if I've not said it already. So there are so many airports that already service our city. And given the indisputable climate impacts a third runway would have, the government has to make a decision in that: does it want to be taken seriously as tackling the single biggest issue of climate in our sort of country and in our world, or does it want to give in to the people who will be pouring the drinks for Rachel Reeves and Davos? And
Elusive search for growth.
Yeah, and I suspect that they're going to win. The question is, will Ed Miliband have the courage to resign? Over to you, Ed.
Stay posted. Okay, that's the week unwrapped. Lots to discuss this week, but coming up, we'll return to the news that Axel Rudakabane, the Southport killer who murdered three girls and attempted to murder 10 others, has been sentenced to life in prison with a minimum of 52 years behind bars. We'll ask how this atrocity was allowed to happen, and now that a public inquiry has been called, what must change to prevent attacks like this happening again? Should these incidents be classed as terrorism? That's next on Politics Uncensored.
Politics Uncensored with Ali Milani and Zoe Grunewald on Fubar Radio. That Money Show with Gabriel Nussbaum.
I'd love to ask for people that look at you. What's one tip you would say to someone that potentially wants to be a future Chancellor of the Exchequer?
I guess I would just encourage all people, but particularly young women, because I'm the first ever woman to be Chancellor of the Exchequer and the post has existed for 800 years.
Oh, wow.
Just to say to all young women and girls, there's no ceiling on your ambition. You can achieve whatever you want. Aim high, dream big, and you can realise your dreams too.
You're listening to Fubar Radio.
Download our app now to listen to your favourite shows, such as Access All Areas, Politics Uncensored, and The Dating Show. You can also download and catch up on previous episodes of all Fubar shows, including our box sets. Plus, you can get in touch directly from within the app.
Just search for Fubar Radio on the Apple and Google App Stores.
The Fubar Radio app. Get it today.
Get it today.
It's the sound of your mates alive. Is getting to more gigs this year and the next. It's the sound of saying, I got you, mate. It's the sound of mates enjoying even more of this. It's the sound of mates getting home instead of here. Click your seatbelt, because you're twice as likely to be killed or seriously injured if you don't think.
When you notice something wrong, it tends to grow and eventually take over, to the point you can't really think of anything else. If something in your body doesn't feel right, the thought it could be cancer can play on your mind. Tests could put your mind at rest. Finding out sooner is always better. Your NHS wants to see you. Contact your GP practice.
What the Health with Gabby Allen.
Now I am joined by Faye Edwards, international fitness presenter. How do you personally stay so motivated?
We are all aging. That is my motivation. Sorry, Gabby. It's the
crying,
truth.
Crying.
And we can't change that, but we can help ourselves and keep our independence for as physically long as possible. It's about lifestyle.
It is.
I have a better lifestyle. That is my motivation.
Access All Areas with Bobby Norris.
We've got Georgia Harrison, my SAS sister. That's when I thought shit's got real.
Well, I got out, didn't I, with my little earmuffs on and my scarf. And they didn't show that either, because obviously I can't put everything in. But he looks at me and he goes, what the fuck are those? And he grabbed my earmuffs and he threw them across the New Zealand landscape. I thought, that's a fucking liberty. £3 from Sheen, they were. I was still in my Sheen Queen era.
Follow us at Politics Uncensored UK for more from the show.
You're listening to Politics Uncensored with me, Ali Milani.
And me, Zoe Grunewald. Now, the Prime Minister, Keir Starmer, spoke on Monday after Southport murderer Axel Rudakabana pleaded guilty to the murder of three young girls and the attempted murder of 10 other people.
This case is a sign. Britain now faces a new threat. Terrorism has changed. In the past, the predominant threat was highly organised groups with clear political intent, groups like Al-Qaeda. That threat, of course, remains. But now, alongside that, we also see acts of extreme violence perpetrated by loners, misfits, young men in their bedroom. The tragedy of the Southport killings must be a line in the sand for Britain. We must make sure the names of those three young girls are not associated with the vile perpetrator, but instead with a fundamental change in how Britain protects its citizens and its children. In pursuit of that, we must, of course, ask and answer difficult questions. Questions that should be far-reaching, unburdened by cultural or institutional sensitivities, and driven only by the pursuit of justice.
In the last hour, Axel Rudakabana has been sentenced to a minimum of 52 years for the murder of three girls at a dance class in Southport last July, and the attempted murder of 10 other people. He also admitted producing ricin, possessing terrorist material and possessing a knife. Well, as you heard there, the Prime Minister has vowed a public inquiry, a change in the law around people's abilities to procure knives, and suggested that terror legislation could change to include incidents like this horrific attack. But is this enough, or does more need to be done in the government in the aftermath of this atrocity? Well, joining us on the programme to discuss this is Chris Phillips, former head of National Counterterrorism Security Office and a former detective chief inspector in the Metropolitan Police. Thank you for joining us once more on the programme, Chris. Can you tell us why this case wasn't considered a terrorist attack and what would actually be needed for it to be considered so?
Yes, terrorism is not just about the violence. The violence is one thing, or the threat of the violence is one thing, but it also needs a motive, and the motive has to be for the purposes of changing government, of changing the way people live, etc. And there's a number of things in there, but this seems to be a person who had extreme violent behaviours, but without the motive to kind of change the world.
Mm. Chris, thanks for coming back on. I wanted to ask you a little bit about whether we use the word terrorism or not, but extreme violence that across our society and how counterterrorism or policing can deal with that. This individual was referred to Prevent three times over the period of 2019 to 2020-21. I think we would all agree that there was a failure to stop the crime happening before it happened. So there is a bit of a question, both from the PM's speech and others, as to whether risk of extreme violence is kind of shifting in our society away from highly organised groups like Al-Qaeda, ISIS and other groups into more sort of loner basement young men who are being radicalised online and are acting on that. Do you think that's the case? And if so, how does policing need to change to deal with that?
Well, that's a big question because, the police and security services across the world have been very good at detecting groups of people before they act. And they've had amazing successes. So if you think since 9/11 and since the London bombings, it's generally not been big groups of people going out to kill lots of people. There's The attacks that we've seen have been individuals, and most times those have been individuals who've been radicalised towards extreme Islam. I mean, that's just the fact of how it is. What we've also got, though, is people in their bedrooms, youngsters, and I think MI5, the head of MI5 a little while ago said, you know, they were picking up people 12, 13 that were viewing incredibly violent stuff on the internet. And then because of that, forming a view of something that they might want to do, and they might want to do something similar, not necessarily to change the world to Islam, but actually to just create violence and perhaps make themselves famous or infamous. Now, those are different things. They're not terrorism, as I explained just now, because the motive isn't there. But it is something that society, and let's not think this is a UK issue. This is a worldwide issue, a Western issue in particular, where our kids are in their bedrooms, on the internet, and becoming more extreme in many ways.
But how do we deal with that, Chris? Because when it's larger groups, presumably it's easier for the police because the more people there are, the bigger the tracks, the easier it is to track down. How do we stop crimes like this happening in the future with sort of loners in their bedrooms looking at stuff online without a serious curtailment of individual freedoms and changing what we are as a society?
Let me
ask a clearer version of the question. Yeah. If you're the head of this division that's looking at this extreme violence and I'm the PM and I'm going, Chris, what do you need from me to stop crimes like this happening in the future? What is that?
Well, nothing can be done without curtailing some of what's on the internet at the moment. You know, the internet is the most fantastic thing in the world. It gives us information, it gives us knowledge that we've never had before, but it also allows bad people to put on bad things. And unfortunately, poor parenting allows children and youngsters and actually some adults as well to review these bad things on the internet and then react to them.
So
now, we've got to find a way of solving that problem. We've got to find a way of getting rid of the horrific stuff that's put on the internet. But also we need some work around parenting. We need to make sure that we know what our kids are looking at. But also as a society, we need to be reporting those people that are extreme and having the resources in place to deal with them.
Chris, one of the sort of political bits of commentary that have been coming out about this case ever since the summer is there's been the suggestion from certain groups that details about the case have been deliberately withheld from the public, and that more should have been told to the public earlier on about Rudy Cabana specifically, perhaps about the motivations behind the attack. They point particularly to the fact that an Al-Qaeda manual was found in his possession. What's your view of this? I mean, is there more that should have been given to the public earlier, or would this have risked prejudicing the trial?
Well, I think we can hide behind this prejudicing the trial piece, but in this, I mean, this is like one of the worst potential, the worst crimes that you could imagine, and society was in shock. And I think it would have been right, for the Prime Minister or the police or someone else to come out and say, look, this guy is not an illegal immigrant for a start. Mm. So let's cut that one out. He was born in Wales. He has clearly got some mental issues. And we have found items that are linked towards terrorism. That doesn't mean to say he is a terrorist. But I think that may have stoked the fires, to be quite honest. It may have eased them. But I think with the way information travels these days, it's very difficult to keep anything quiet. People knew generally, you know, in the media, people knew very quickly about the Ricin and the Islamic book that he downloaded.
Chris, it's not an Islamic book, it's an Al-Qaeda book.
I'm just going to push back on you slightly, if that's okay, Chris, because you say that details should have been given to the public earlier. I mean, I think it was a couple of days after they did reveal that he wasn't immigrant. You also said that this isn't terrorism as we know it, yet you said that they should have been told that he was in possession of a terrorist manual. Do you not think that would have been at risk of further amplifying the misinformation? I mean, isn't it better to keep the knowledge away from the public until they have all the facts, and then they can actually understand what's going on? Otherwise, you're at risk of, you know, producing false narratives and contradictory rumours.
Well, false narratives were out, weren't they? That's the key point. And sometimes you have to correct them. And, you know, I think it's quite possible to talk about certain things without actually prejudicing the trial. I think, you know, the fact that as I said, the fact that he wasn't an illegal immigrant, I mean, that was the key point, I think, that was helping to stoke the riots. And I think that would have been a useful thing to have put out quite quickly. Mm. Some truths need to come out in order to stop this mass of incorrect information flying around the world, and of course it's very difficult to put that back in the box.
Chris, I want to take you back to this internet stuff, because look, one of the things I'm curious about is our current method of dealing with extreme violence, I don't want to use the word terrorism because it implies political ideology, but extreme planned violence in our country fit for purpose? Because I worry a little bit that we may end up swinging towards, and you know what's happening in America with school shootings, a lot of this stuff comes online. Do you think the government should explore some form of censorship of content online, extreme content online, or is, you know, because I'm trying to figure out how can the police in any way deal with this sort of thing?
Well, I think yes, I do. I not necessarily think the government should do that. I think the internet companies themselves should. And of course, this is the big argument that they say they just put things out there. They're just a platform to allow other people to put their views out. Some of those views you might find offensive. But, you know, there's a constant stream now of extreme violence that needs to be curtailed. And yes, you would hope that the internet companies are best placed to do that. If they fail to do that, then I think maybe governments around the world need to start thinking about that. But this is such a difficult subject. It's one that's been floated around for many years. You know, what's on the internet, as I said, 90% of it is great. Some of it is downright terrible.
Chris, one last question from me, quite a pointed one, if I may. This individual had been referred to prevent three times over 2019 to 2021. He had taken things like knives and hockey sticks to school. There is an allegation, particularly from Muslim communities, that if he had been Muslim or come from a Muslim background, he would have been caught before this happened. Do you think that's true?
Quite possibly. I think the issue was that this wasn't viewed as a terrorist. This was viewed as a kid going off the rails that needed to be dealt with by social services. Whereas, you know, in hindsight, we now know that he did download some terrorist stuff and he did have some ricin. But he clearly fell down through the cracks, and it's something that we need to learn for the future. But let me tell you, you know, governments have been taking away our ability to deal with this. You know, stop and search for policing has been curtailed. That's how you stop people kids from carrying knives. You've got the social services have lost staff, police have lost staff. There's no prison places. All these things put together make our society a much more dangerous place.
Mm. Chris Phillips, thank you very much. Chris Phillips there, former head of the National Counterterrorism Security Office and a former detective chief inspector in the Metropolitan Police.
It's Ali Milani and Zoe Grunewald with Politics Uncensored. FUBAR Radio.
Ali, we just heard there from Chris Phillips, who was the former head of the National Terrorism Office. What do you think of his assessment?
So, look, first of all, let me just address what he said at the end in my question, whether if he was Muslim, he would have been caught. And I think Chris was honest. He said it, possibly so. And I think part of the problem there is we're obsessed with definition, terrorism, extreme violence, all these kinds of things. But it seems the police is so obsessed when it comes to sort of planned extreme violence with Muslim communities, it has missed a huge other areas of planned organized violence. Chris said the majority of sort of these kinds of violence are radical Islam. Again, the data across Europe is actually Islamist or radical Islam is a tiny minority of that. But there is certainly a changing sort of culture in the types of violence that we can expect, and I fear that we may be going down an American route.
For me, I think the thing that really stood out is the fact that when you look at how many red flags there were in Rudy Cabana's behaviour, you know, he was flagged to the Prevent Scheme three times, he was excluded from school, I think he was charged with assault, you know, he'd been found to be carrying a weapon on a number of occasions. The idea that this man, you know, this boy, was not getting any kind of, you know, it was actually impossible to separate him from the community in many ways. And, you know, this horrific story of him trying to return to his former school a week before the attack, and his father had to basically grapple with him and the taxi driver to get him to stay. You know, parents are, we hear time and time again, having to support their children through these kind of, you know, I'm not saying this was a mental health crisis, but you hear of a case where the state is so stripped back that it is almost expected that parents would in some way be able to stop their child from doing something like this, even though he was 1 week away from being a fully grown adult male. That, to me, talks about failures of the state at all kinds of levels to be able to protect society and ensure that those who are dangerous or those who are having a mental health episode or those who need, you know, support are no longer getting it. And, you know, I think what will be really interesting about this national inquiry is it may look at Prevent, it may look at the failures of local authorities, but I bet you the one thing it is going to find, as it will find time and time again, is that there were not enough resources in any of these local authorities, in the police, in the Prevent system, to do anything about this boy who clearly was a repeat risk.
Yeah, I think you've hit the nail on the head here, and this is what I worry about a national inquiry, and it's what Chris said at the end. If you pay attention to what Chris said at the end, when we asked him what needs to be done, he spoke about things like stop and search and more police officers. I've been doing the show for like a year and a half, been doing media for like 10 years. I've never heard a police officer say, you know what, we've got enough police officers, there's other things that need to be challenged. Police officers and the policing system are always going to ask for more resources. Of course they are, that's what they do. The reality is the data and experts in the field suggest that some of the key indicators in changing this behavior are actually things like youth clubs. It's things like providing more mental health facilities for schools. That's where this starts. We learnt this in the days of quote-unquote sort of extremism coming from the Muslim community. We were begging the government. We were saying, listen, the best way of tackling this is through communities. Mm. You can't alienate communities. They have the best intel, right? Some officer sat in Scotland Yard is not going to tell you better than what this kid's parents or teachers would have told you. And so that's why I worry is that a national inquiry that asks police officers what do you need and things other than is only going to regurgitate the stuff we've always had. What we actually need is a more health-centric approach, a more community-centric approach that that aims to intervene at an earlier stage with these kids and stop them going down this route. Because there's only two options. You either curtail what they can see on the internet once they've already gone down the sort of anti-establishment, sort of disconnected with society route, or you intervene at an earlier level. I fear I know what the answer of that inquiry is.
I think if you take away young people's spaces, you send them straight into the arms of the internet, which is full of hate and violence. Okay, coming up, how will Labour deal with a second Donald Trump presidency? Well, it's been revealed that Keir Starmer has set up a mini cabinet to try and plan around Trump's notorious unpredictability. But will past comments from Labour senior ministers come back to haunt the government and affect the so-called special relationship between the UK and the US? All that and more next.
Fubar Radio. That Money Show with Gabriel Nussbaum.
I'd love to ask for people that look at you, what's one tip you would say to someone that potentially wants to be a future Chancellor of the Exchequer?
I guess I would just encourage all people, but particularly young women, because I'm the first ever woman to be Chancellor of the Exchequer and the post has existed for 800 years.
Oh, wow.
Just to say to all young women and girls, there's no ceiling on your ambition. You can achieve whatever you want. Aim high, dream big, and you can realise your dreams too.
You're listening to Fubar Radio.
Download our app now to listen to your favourite shows, such as Access All Areas, Politics Uncensored, and The Dating Show. You can also download and catch up on previous episodes of all Fubar shows, including our box sets. Plus, you can get in touch directly from within the app.
Just search for Fubar Radio on the Apple and Google App Stores.
Yeah. The Fubar Radio app. Get it today.
Get it today.
I was fine on this beach the other day. I didn't know the time of high tide changes, and I had no idea it could come in so fast. So I'm finding out the hard way. From this fella, the Coast Guard, who dropped in to get me out.
Ready!
Before you go to the coast, check the tide times online. In an emergency, call 999 and ask for the Coast Guard.
Some companies try to reel people in by promising quick cash if you pay them to claim work expenses. But think twice before taking the bait, because they might just want to land a commission, and it turns out you aren't eligible to claim anything. You'll have to pay HMRC back, and it's unlikely the company will refund any fees. So don't get caught out. Check if you're eligible and make a claim with HMRC for free online. Just search Don't Get Caught Out.
What the Hell with Gabby Allen.
Now I am joined by Faye Edwards, international fitness presenter. How do you personally stay so motivated?
We are all aging. That is my motivation. Sorry, Gabby. It's the
crying,
truth.
Crying.
And we can't change that, but we can help ourselves and keep our independence for as physically long as possible. It's about lifestyle.
It is.
I have a better lifestyle. That is my motivation.
Access All Areas with Bobby Norris.
We've got Georgia Harrison, my SIS sister. That's when I thought shit's got real.
Well, I got out, didn't I, with my little earmuffs on and my scarf. And they didn't show that either because obviously I can't put everything in. But he looks at me and he goes, what the fuck are those? And he grabbed my earmuffs and he threw them across the New Zealand landscape. I thought, that's a fucking liberty. £3 from Sheen, they were. I was still in my Sheen Queen era.
Politics Uncensored on Fubar Radio.
Welcome back. You're listening to Politics Uncensored with me, Ali Milani.
And me, Zoe Grunewald. Now, if you are a senior Labour politician, welcome to the programme. I think we would all love to know what you've been thinking about over the course of the past few days.
I mean, we've got the highest death rates in Europe, and Donald Trump is killing, you know, thousands of Americans by giving them duff advice and his macho, I'm all right, you know, look at me, I've survived COVID. He's an absolute buffoon. He has no place in the White House. He's an embarrassment, and he should be ashamed of himself.
I don't think any of us could have believed that a man full of such bile, such hatred, such evil would get his hands on what at its best is the beacon of freedom in the world. And so this presidency is worse than any of us could ever, ever have imagined.
You said Trump is such an odious, sad little man. Imagine being proud to have that as your president. How would you deal with President-elect Trump, who has a very long memory for stuff like that?
Well, two things. Firstly, the Prime Minister, the Foreign Secretary have been working hard to build a relationship with President Trump and his team so that in the event that he is elected as the next president of the United States, we start with the strong working relationship, which is in our national interest.
Now, that's not good listening if you're a Labour MP sitting on the front benches, having previously criticised Donald Trump. As you heard there, many senior Labour politicians, including the Prime Minister, Sir Keir Starmer, and his deputy, Angela Rayner, have since rode back on their previous comments and congratulated Donald Trump on his inauguration. But just how will these comments affect London's relationship with Washington in the 4 years ahead? There have already been rumours that Donald Trump might refuse Peter Mandelson, a Labour grandee's appointment to the position of British ambassador to the US. And Trump has yet to mention relations with the UK since coming to office. The government's position is awkward and unenviable, to put it mildly. The government say the PM will visit Washington for talks with President Trump within the next coming weeks. But it was revealed this week that there have been a series of secret mini-cabinet meetings with the PM, the Chancellor Rachel Reeves, the Foreign Secretary David Lammy, and the business secretary, Jonathan Reynolds, trying to plan for what might come, according to a source. So what happens next? And how does Labour deal with a Trump presidency that has already come out of the gate swinging? Ali, what suggestions would you give to your Labour colleagues?
Can I start? Those quotes are so much worse than I remember.
It sounds worse when it comes out of their mouths directly and isn't just reported, I think.
Yeah. Do you know what you don't do? Pretend like you never said them.
Mm.
And this is actually, I think, part of the problem with politics now, why nobody takes politics seriously and why the general public just use that they're all the same, they're all sort of bullshitters, is we now have a bunch of Labour Party politicians who I understand why they're doing it, but it's wrong nonetheless, pretending they never thought these things and never said these things. The appointment of Peter Mandelson is an absolute own goal that should have never happened.
Talk about that then. Why would you say that?
Well, I'll tell you why. Because, look, Peter Mandelson himself has said things about Donald mm-hmm. Trump on the record. Traditionally in this country, unlike America, the appointment of ambassadors is a non-political role. So senior diplomats get appointed to these posts based on their experience in Foreign Office, possibly based on their experience in the consulate in America and existing relationships that they have. So we have never had political appointments. This is a break from tradition that Keir Starmer has done. And clearly, in my view, something has happened in which Peter Mandelson has been appointed. Now, Trump is saying that he may not accept that appointment, and that causes further problems. But for one, what they should have done is either kept the current senior diplomat in Washington, who already has existing relationship, or put someone there with the experience necessary to lean on existing relationships in the GOP and in the Republican Party to try and bring the president on board. What Keir Starmer has done is completely taken the ball from within the penalty spot on the opponent's side, run all these yards to and scored an own goal, basically, by appointing Peter Mandelson.
See, that's a football metaphor that I understood because it was very simple.
Thank you very much. So that's one. I think we should have gone with a senior career diplomat in Washington. The second part is, what do we know about Donald Trump? The thing is, we've lived through a term of Donald Trump. Donald Trump does not deal with weakness well. He's a traditional bully who deals with strength. So the way to do it isn't to try and pretend you haven't said all these things, or to try and charm him in any sort of way that's not going to work, but it's to exude strength. Donald Trump's best relationships during his time in office was with Vladimir Putin and Kim Jong-il, right? Because he saw them as strong men. Strong men react well with strong men. What I worry about is that we are exhibiting nothing but sort of meek weakness to an American bully that may end up running through us if we're not careful. So I think actually it's also a bigger story than it's not just a sort of flavor story. It could have real economic impacts if he places tariffs on importing or exporting British and American goods here and abroad. But it's a serious problem that we chuckle at, largely because now Angela Rayner, Wes Street and David Lammy are trying to pretend they didn't say the things we just heard them say.
So I just want to go back to the ambassador, because I'm inclined to agree with you about Mandelson. I mean, I think the thing he has in common with Trump is his
relationship with a certain...
I think that they're both princes of darkness, aren't they? And perhaps, you know, there'll be some sort of mirror imaging of some parts of them going on.
Maybe they once ran into each other on holiday on an island.
I agree with you. I don't think he's a good choice. I mean, I think you need someone with a strong moral backbone going against Donald Trump.
But also existing relationships in Washington.
Okay, so either you have a strong moral backbone or you have an existing relationship. Because it's quite hard to have both with Donald Trump, right? So the other option you go for is you go for someone who has a good relationship with Donald Trump but could be more of a risk to a Labour government. Perhaps
don't do it, Zoe.
Nigel Farage or Boris Johnson. How terrible would that be?
Well, first of all, Nigel Farage didn't even make it to the rotunda. Poor Nigel, he didn't make it into the list of...
It's because he was in Clacton, mate.
No, he was in Washington, first of all, but he didn't make it to the A-list invitees, so he had to sit outside. By the way, it's the most cringe thing I've ever seen. All these right-wing politicians like Suella Braverman flying to America.
With Lawrence Fox.
I think Priti Patel was there. Nigel Farage was obviously there, although Nigel Farage was invited. And others just begging for, like, any attention that these MAGA right-wingers will give them. And then they come back home and pretend to be these proud British patriots who's simping for an American political cult. It's just the most secondhand embarrassment I've ever got, but I'll leave that.
So I think it's going to come back to bite the Tories, actually, this Kemi Badenoch and Jenrick and all this kind of Tory simping for MAGA. Because, yes, the Tories and the Republicans are sister parties, but this iteration of Republican Party is way more closely linked to Reform. And I think they are going to find themselves in a position at some point, I would say even in the next 3 months, 3 months to 6 months, where Trump does something or says something so despicable that it's going to be put to Kemi Badenoch, and she either continues to toe the line, in which case she divides her party in two, because there are already plenty of people in the Conservative Party, what is left, I would say plenty, what I mean is what is left of the centre-right, who are deeply uncomfortable with the party aligning themselves with Trump.
Or what happens if he places seriously economically damaging tariffs on us? Are they going to continue?
Are they going to support them? Yeah. Are they going to support Donald Trump? I think they are making a rod for their own back by, as you say, simping. Instead, they should do what I actually think Keir Starmer and the Labour Party are doing to the best of the ability, considering the stupid comments they've made in the past, which is just being as diplomatic as they can be about the whole thing. Because we have no idea what Trump is going to do to the UK. What I do think, we do have an ace up our sleeve. King Charles.
Yeah, he does have
Donald
good relationships
Trump
with the royals.
Loves the royal family. He loves Britain. He loves our institutions. He loves our golf courses. He loves our tea. If there's some diplomatic crisis, send them all in. Send Princess Anne in, send King Charles in, send Prince William in. Hell, send maybe not Meghan. You could try Harry. Send them all in for a royal tea party.
What's Charlotte? How old is Charlotte? Can she get on a plane
deploy your king.
That's true. I actually saw a video of Trump who clearly really loved his time with the late Queen when he was in Britain, because he was showing pictures while he was on the plane to that. That's certainly true. I think the royals could play a significant role here. But more than anything, what I urge both Conservatives and Labour governments to do is do not, in a sort of Discovery Channel term, do not show your belly to Donald Trump. because he's a man inclined to attack. We're not a weak country. We're not a country without influence. We can exert strength, and he will react to that. Mm. If we continue down this line of simping for him or trying desperately to get him to forget things that we've said in the past, it won't work, because he also holds onto a grudge like you won't believe. So I really, really hope that part of the diplomacy is to show some strength, not to run away from things that you've said in the past. And depending on whether Mandelson gets accepted or not, actually maybe changing your appointment for the most senior diplomat that you've got in Washington. This may come out to be one of the worst decisions that Starmer's made early in his term.
Well, we'll keep you posted. We'll inevitably see in the coming weeks how Trump intends to treat the UK over his 4-year term in office. And we'll be here to keep you up to date on just how fucked we are the entire time.
Politics Uncensored with Ali Milani and Zoe Grunewald on FUPAR Radio.
Well, that's all from Politics Uncensored today. We've covered a lot. Join us every Thursday at 5 p.m. where we unwrap the week's political talking points. You can stay up to date with the show by following us at Politics Uncensored UK on social media, where you can find me at Ali Milani UK.
And you can find me at Zoe Grunewald.
If you've missed any of today's show, you can listen back and catch up at FUBARradio.com or on the FUBAR Radio app.
Download it from your app store now.
Thanks for listening. See you next week for another episode of Politics Uncensored.
Follow us at Politics Uncensored UK for more from the show.